awesome.
Okay. So I wanted to speak a little bit about potential proofs to God. What the Mefarshim say, which do say this, which don't say this, etc., etc. There are Mefarshim out there who believe you can prove God. The Rambam was convinced he could prove God. Rastajan was convinced he could prove God. The more modern world, people think you can prove God less. I'm not sure if it's post-Immanuel Kant. He was a big big philosopher, and really was one of the first people who kind of like the introduction to modern or post-modern, I guess, afterwards, philosophy. There are other more modern people like the Meshech Chachmer, Rasham Shafal Hirsch, who you can't prove God. Rasham Shafal Hirsch, at the beginning of 19 letters, actually, a little discussion. 19 letters were written to a secular German boy who was trying, who basically felt Judaism was archaic and ancient and totally not relevant to his life. Rasham Shafal Hirsch was like, listen, I can't prove to you that this is right and true in the world, but let me tell you about it, let me tell you a little bit about it. You should at least make your decision based upon knowing what it is and what we believe in, our ideology, our shkaf, what we are, and you'll make your decision at the end of the day. And to be honest with you, most people I know, not everyone, and I say most people, even though I mean everyone, because I want to just say most people, because it could be one or two skeptics in the room think I'm wrong, I don't want to be presumptuous, it could be one or two people out there listening on, who sent their numerous CDs, tapers, iPods over here to tape it, you know, it could be, what's it called, this is my cell phone, I just thought it would fit right in. There are people out there, and I don't know everyone, so I'm not 100% convinced this is true, but that, you know, most people I've met have not chose to be religious, not to be religious. What religion, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, any other religion, I am or not aware of. Many people, if not everyone, make their decision not whether or not there are proofs to God, not whether or not the philosophy is good enough. Most people choose to or not to believe in God based upon social reasons, emotional reasons, psychological reasons, sociological reasons, but less philosophical reasons. Don't get me wrong. If you need philosophical reasons to at least feel like you're making an intelligent decision. But most people I know, if you think about it, why is it that certain people who are born Jewish don't convert? Same thing with Islam and Christianity. Why is it 95% of the world doesn't convert? Is it that big of a coincidence that all Islamic thinkers just happen to coincidentally believe that Islam is most likely to be true? And all Buddhist thinkers, just by chance, they all did the same objective research. It just happened to be they bumped into Buddhism, we bumped into Judaism, etc., etc. And even the converts amongst the group, most of them have stories of which, you know, not all. Most converts, you speak to them, why is it? They say they thought Judaism was true or whatever religion it is that's true, but they have some type of story that they weren't happy, the Rebbe didn't like them, the Rebbe did like them, the priest touched them the wrong way, whatever the story may be that turns people on or off to religions. The priest touching was, needless to say, not a physical touching. It was a... But whatever the case may be, in other words, people make decisions. In other words, people are happy with religion. They stick with it. People are unhappy with it. They don't stick with it. Sometimes you have a person whose Rebbe was a great Rebbe. He's like, wow, religion's great. No matter how good the Rebbe is, that has no impact on whether or not God exists or whether or not Judaism is true. But to us, it does. You hear some tremendous shan, the 15 from people get arrested for stealing money. People want to be less religious, they want to identify less with these type of things. Again, this has no impact on the validity of the Rabbona Shel Olam. A person has an arrogance, a very strong sense of gaiva. He wants to be smarter than anyone in the world. He doesn't want to believe God's smarter than him. These type of things happen. A person wants to feel the sense of meaning. What would the world be like without God? I don't know, but that doesn't mean that there is a God. It may mean it's worthwhile to try to live a religious life, but objectively speaking, God exists or doesn't exist. If there's no God, okay, there's no meaning in the world. Life is tough. But just because you want there to be meaning doesn't mean there is God. Many, many, many people, if not all, basically choose to believe or not to believe. And that, I think, is because none of the proofs are black and white, crystal clear. And that's why, if you look around in the world, you'll find many, many smart thinkers. Philosophers, theologians, and everyone else out there who's smart and trying their best to figure out what to do with their life, that's why they're all coming to different conclusions. There are enough Jewish thinkers out there who are absolute geniuses that you can feel totally confident that Judaism, at least a good chance it's true. Unfortunately, Judaism is the only people who has, the only religion who has smart people. A lot of smart philosophers who believe in the atheistic religion or the Western culture religion. There are a lot of smart Christian thinkers, Christian theologians who believe in Christianity, and a lot of smart Buddhists who believe in Buddhism, etc., etc. That being the case, and I'm not someone who believes you can prove God, in a minute or two I'm going to try my best to give the best proofs or supports, or what I call, there's a book written by Lawrence Kellerman called Permission to Believe. I thought the book was good. I did. I liked it. But I thought the title was great. At the end of the day, I can't convince you that I'm right. I can't convince you that God exists. I can't convince you Judaism is true. But what I'd like to do is build enough of a case that you feel confident and comfortable believing. At the end of the day, although we make psychological, emotional, sociological, social, whatever they are, decisions, nonetheless, if there's no basis at all, no one's going to make that decision. At the end of the day, you want to be as well educated, both in terms of making that leap of faith smaller, as well as, because it's a wonderful thing to do, to know philosophy, know Jewish theology, know what the Chachmei HaMesor is saying. Therefore, Mamash, in 2 minutes, I'm going to just kind of give you a few of the major, three or four of the major arguments that the Mefarshim have towards God, towards Judaism, a little bit of both the proofs, etc., etc. One more point, I'll take around the questions, I'll move on to the actual quote-unquote proofs. It's difficult to prove things. That's one of the reasons why I think there are no crystal clear proofs. Many, many people follow, again, probably Kantian philosophy, which says, even the things that we do see, it could just be everything's totally subjective through our own eyes. I once heard someone talking about, you know, it could be that I'm wearing a blue shirt right now, and everyone calls it blue, but it could be the color you see is what I call red, but all your life you were told it was blue, and therefore we're looking at two different colors, our eyes see them differently, but we're just trained to title it blue, right? You have no idea really what shirt I'm wearing is. We're all seeing the same color. Whatever color we see, we just call it blue. Everything you see is totally subjective through your own eyes. And even if there are objective proofs in the world, it could be they only seem objective to us through our own spectacles, through our own eyeglass, through our own eyesight, number one. See, if everything we say, I'm not even sure it's really true in the first place. Number one. Number two, it's very difficult to prove things. If I'm not mistaken, it was Descartes who said, I think, therefore I am. Basically, his point was, the only thing I can prove is that I exist. I don't know if I'm a person. How do we know we really exist? Maybe the whole thing is a figment of our imagination. Maybe you don't exist. How do you know we exist? How do I know I'm here? I think I am. Maybe I just think I am. That's right. Maybe I just think I am. So his argument was, I think, therefore I am. The fact that I'm thinking means something on some minuscule level is going on. Even if I'm just a brain in a box somewhere, okay. But the fact that there's thought means there's something. I may not be sitting in this chair, I may not be wearing a blue shirt, I may not be sitting in this thing, that's maybe a figment of my imagination, but at least it means I have an imagination. That's about as far as most philosophers have proof in terms of our existence. And therefore, really the point is, it's very difficult to prove things. Taking all this into account, nonetheless, I'd like to offer three or four major arguments which allow a person to have the permission to believe, which allow a person to feel comfortable and confident with their acceptance of Judaism, which allow a person who is an objective but also intelligent person to say, you want to know what? None of these arguments are foolproof to the exclusion of everything else, and I am 100% sure that God exists, and all I have to do is just tell people and the whole world will believe in Judaism. For that, maybe we have to allow until Mashiach comes. But nonetheless, they are, on some level, they're good enough proof between, I'll call it somewhere between 51 and 99%, they're good enough, or between 1 and 99, I don't know exactly the number, but they're good enough that, A, the Chachmei HaMesor have said that, which says a lot, and B, they're good enough that I think that one could feel confident and comfortable, both, allowing themselves to live a committed life on Judaism. There's a good chance that these are again, are they perfect soundproof arguments? I don't know, but they're definitely good arguments. Questions? One, two, one.
Is by proving that atheism and that there is no God can't be true, proving that there is no God, proving that ideology?
Meaning, if you can prove that the following statement is false, there is no God, most likely there is a God, meaning either there is a God or there isn't. Those are probably two choices. Now, what type of God and what is God and what not? It's very difficult to disprove the atheist. Even most people in the world who say they're atheists, really they just don't know the terminology. They mean they're agnostics, which means I'm not sure that God exists. Could be he does, but I don't know. And therefore, it's not worth it for me to commit, so I'll just live a life a God-free life. Very few people can disprove, I mean, anyone can disprove God. Not just because I believe God exists, but also because, like, how could you do that? Sometimes people just kind of think, hey, listen, it's 80-20, probably not, so I won't commit. That thing. Yeah.
Did the Hafnei Messiah believe that there was a foolproof truth or not?
Tough to know. A lot of them definitely did. The Rambam probably did. The Rav Sajigon probably did. I'm not sure if they have different understandings of proofs. I think they do. Meaning, they probably translate the word differently or understand it differently or something differently, because I don't think any of them are black on white proofs, and, you know, it could just be the word proof developed again, especially pre and post Kant. Probably is a good chance the word proof has a different meaning. But it could be that really the Rambam has the same idea of proof as me, and somehow I'm just totally missing everything he's talking about. Or it could be that, you know, in the world of philosophy, the Rambam would be the first one to tell you this. If I'm wrong, throw out what I have to say. The Rambam didn't like what he said because he said he liked it because that was true. And if you'd argued him and pointed out to him that it wasn't true, he'd be the first, I think, he'd be the first one to say, okay, there you go, we're looking for truth over here. Sure. So my best thing is that they are arguments, but probably they meant something else by true proof. But it could be it's a proof that I'm just missing it. Or it could be it's not a proof and he just thought it was and he's wrong. But you know, again.
If I remember, so also in the Ashen, they're told to know God, they're not only told to believe it.
That's a question, what does that word mean? That's a much more question of partial. Can you know God? Can you not know God? And if you can know God, then maybe these are proofs. And if you can't know God, then come as close as you can, type of thing. But is there ever a mitzvah to know God? I'm not sure. The Rambam has such a lashon. The Rambam, the beginning of Hilchas, Sodei Torah has such a lashon of Leida, Sheisham, whatever. The Chumash, I'm not sure, I have to look at it more carefully. I don't think so. Yeah. Question, no question.
So surely then, therefore, everyone is an agnostic.
Well,
so they're saying the atheists aren't really atheists, and therefore theorists.
Meaning, it's a question of semantics. Either you would say, you know, people who are convinced there's no God, they don't have a proof that there's no God, but they're convinced there's no God. I guess you can call them atheists. Maybe it doesn't. It's not sure. Maybe you're right. Your point's a fair one. Either no one knows for sure there is a God and has a proof, unless they do have proofs and we just can figure it out. But me, who believes there is no real proof, so. I guess the Manushap is really just like a semantics game, but your point's a fair one. Okay. So I'd like to discuss three major proofs that the Chachmei and Masorah have, and a few other points afterwards. The first one is, it's said it in several different ways. The Medrash Tanchuma actually quotes a machlokas, or a discussion rather, between Rabbi Kiva versus the heretic, where the heretic came over to Rabbi Kiva and said to him, how do you know there's a God? And Rabbi Kiva had a very simple answer. Sew your clothes. Who put together your clothing? And he said that, well, the tailor sewed it. How do you know that? Maybe it came together by, how do you know that? He goes, well, every person looks at the garment, knows that its creator was a tailor. Rabbi Kiva basically said, same point here. You find this Rav Sajigon developing the same type of idea. Rav Elchanan Wasserman has the same type of idea in the Kovetz Ma'amarim. It's essentially what Alex alluded to. It's called the watchmaker theory, which basically means you see a watch, you know there was a watchmaker. Rav Elchanan actually takes it one step further, and I'd like to develop it, but Rav Elchanan actually takes it one step further. He says, not only is there a world, but if there's a world, there must have been a creator, and if there's a creator, he must have had some type of purpose for the world, or some type of accomplishment, or something to do with the world, and not just the world itself. And therefore, not only does the watchmaker theory indicate that there was not only the fact that there's a watchman, there's a watchmaker, but it even means that he gave us some type of instruction book, or some type of guide, or Rav Elchanan calls it the Torah. He takes it one step further, Rav Elchanan takes it. Nonetheless, this is the basic theory. The world is so intricate and so sophisticated and so profound and so detailed and so nuanced that there's no way it happened like this by itself. I'll develop it slightly. Lamashal, the digestive system. Pardon the immaturity for a second. It's totally awesome, no?
Yeah.
Meaning, you eat a sandwich, somehow, totally subconsciously, after you're done chewing it up, you know how to kind of swallow it down. You don't think about doing that. Once it gets into your stomach, and unfortunately my knowledge of the biography is not sophisticated enough to properly biology is not strong enough to really take it further. But once it gets into your stomach, all sorts of cool things happen. Somehow your body takes away the calcium and puts it this way, and somehow your body takes away the protein and sends it that way, and somehow the body takes away the carbohydrates and sends it to men to their stomach, women to their bottom. I don't know how your body knows how to do these things. It's unbelievable. How does it know exactly what's waste and not what I'm not waste? And I don't even know how I'm working. You know what I'm saying? Bachshon has three children. My kid's born a day, and somehow his body knows how to do this. The kid doesn't know anything about anything. The kid doesn't know if he's alive or not, doesn't know his mother, consciously has nothing. But subconsciously, your body's working unbelievably well. Again, I'll deal with the mature crowd here for a second, but the reproductive system is unbelievable. A man and a woman sleep together. Totally random, bizarre act. And somehow the man, people know what happens when a man gets excited type of thing, and women, the whole deal, the zera goes out, and it's not just any zera. You put zebra zera in a woman, or animal, or donkey zera, or elephant zera, none of that works. It has to be man zera. So I'm pretty sure it's maturity. I'm serious. You put black man zera in, you get a black kid. You put Chinese man zera, you get a Chinese kid. I'm saying it's unbelievable that how detailed it is. It goes into the woman. She has no clue what the heck is taking place for 9 months. She does absolutely nothing, and she creates a person. And it's always 9 months, and it's always a male or a female that comes out. It always has two eyes, it always has a nose. Some woman who never paid attention, never made a mistake, and created some kid with six noses. Like, that just didn't happen. They forgot to give someone an eye, and there it is, just one eye. The other thing is just totally blank. These things don't happen. And that little kid who came out has no clue how anything works, and all of a sudden he begins to grow up. And he begins to think and talk and have his own creative independent thoughts. And not only is that true, but at some level he can mamish reproduce again himself. You think about how many infinite amounts of children are in that one child. It's a crazy thought. And to think that on such a simple level it's true, in other words, that started from nothing without a creator, very difficult to imagine. I once heard Rabbi Tendler say it best. Pardon the way he said it. I don't know if you appreciated it. It had a very funny connotation to it as well. You'll see in a second. He goes, if there's a big bang, there must have been a big banger. The reason why it's funny is because the standard terminology for the Ravono Shalom is not the big banger. Some might even find that disrespectful and offensive, but I think it's awesome. In other words, that's really the point. If there was a big bang, there was a big bang. The big bang is so, and especially because the big bang didn't start with nothing. In other words, at some point in time, something had to start somewhere. And even if it works, even if God works through the big bang and through the world of physics and through the world of chemistry, through the world of biology, nonetheless, it all comes down to God. It's too much of a coincidence. There's no way this could have happened on its own. And even if you tell me, if you put enough monkeys in a room, eventually they'll learn to produce Shakespearean poetry, they won't learn to fly. Point being that even if they have, if there's an infinite amount of things, something may happen, I'm not sure this would happen. Taking that all into account, argument number one, proof number one, suggestion number one to God is look how intricate, look how detailed, look how sophisticated the world is. And, there are people who question this, and there are others definitely a second side, but I think this is definitely a legitimate, intelligent argument to make. Yeah?
Isn't that kind of thrown to the side by Descartes' philosophy? Like by saying that, you're saying that since I see the whole world is so intricate, there must be a creator. Now, it's on a lower level, but if I don't even know if that whole world exists, I don't know if anything exists outside of me. For all I know, everything here, including all these iPods,
twofold,
a thing of my imagination.
You're right. Twofold. Number one is no one really thinks that you don't exist. Most people think they exist, even though that you can't prove it. Nonetheless, people are pretty confident about that. And number two is, and even if you don't exist, well, your imagination is pretty sophisticated also. And that also may indicate that, something out there exists. But point well taken, it is minimized slightly. But nonetheless, I think it's something that most of us can feel relatively speaking confident about. Argument number two. Yeah?
What about the idea that scientists don't believe that? Many scientists don't believe that, not the majority.
The truth.
We were talking about it, this digestive system is amazing. Most doctors who actually study with the digestive system don't look at them and think, wow, there must be a God.
Most doctors look and say, wow, something crazy is going on. And again, the question as to.
The digestive system has been explained. Not the Big Bang theory isn't a full explanation.
Scientists explain how it works, they don't explain why it works and what started it working.
Evolution's.
Yeah. It's true. Most philosophers, most scientists probably would say something like that. I guess twofold. Number one is evolution itself, whether it exists or not, and most philosophers really do it, and almost everyone probably just would accept it on some level. We'd be very difficult to reject it completely. In other words, that nothing ever changed in the human people. Chinese people were created Chinese back from day one. You know what I'm saying? My Russian cousin looks totally different from me. You know, my Russian second cousin, even though I have the same great-grandparents. I think Russians just somehow get rounder faces. I don't know why. You know what I'm saying? In other words, I'm like, black people just get blacker. It's just how things work. It's not saying revolutionary thoughts here. People just look different. You come from different countries. The world, so it makes a difference. So evolution is probably true on some level. But even evolution has had a fully developed theory as to what started things and how they developed one to the next and why it was that, you know, that certain things, evolution, certain things evolved into certain things and other things not. There's still a huge amount of questions on that theory. If your question is why do most doctors / professors in psychology, professors of science, not accept it, I think it's much more of a psychological question than a philosophical one. That's what I really believe. I think it's really true, though.
I'm not sure. I have issues with that.
Okay, we'll talk about it afterwards. Yeah.
On that, because like 100 years ago, they didn't know the answer to a lot of these questions. So how can you answer questions that we know maybe answer in the future? I would have thought.
They didn't know the answer to which questions?
Like the biological systems, you know, how they kind of work. And now we do know those answers, scientific answers. So how can we answer unanswered scientific questions with God? How can we say that it's all wondrous because of God, and there may be something else to evolution. The unanswered questions of evolution may be answered in the future. How can we answer unanswered questions for God that may be answered in the future?
I feel bad not knowing what you're talking about because you said it three times. I'm just going to ask you to hold off politely and you'll ask me afterwards. I really want to talk about it because it sounds like it's like something clever and creative. I want to think about it.
We'll get an answer in the future.
Maybe we'll get an answer in the future. Maybe.
I
don't know. I'm saying, in other words, whoever holds this answer, when whatever information you're coming out, have to rethink what I'm saying. Either it'll be true or not true. It could be you'll be able to read to defend what I'm talking about. It could be you'll be like, hey, look at this. Turns out this argument of Rabbi Akiva and the Rasaja going just holds a lot less water now that we have all this new scientific breakthrough. It could be the scientific breakthrough will further their thought. Look at that. We thought we understood all this stuff. We really don't understand anything. I don't know. Let's find out what the future has to say. The best I can do is speak about what I know and don't know right now. And it's true, there are a lot of scientists who talk about evolution. We'll talk about evolution afterwards if you want. Let me get through the other stuff first. What I want to talk about. I have no problem sitting talking about evolution for a long time afterwards. It's important not to get caught up with this. Whatever new theories the modern scientists believe must be fact. You know what I mean? In other words, I think that's a lot of what they themselves get caught up with that. I'm saying, we'll talk about it more afterwards. I'll chip away at two or three things. There's a lot of what they say that has legitimacy. There's a lot of what they say that I think is, blinded by what they want to believe and blinded by each other, post objective stuff. But not all of it. A lot of it's really good, a lot of it's not. We'll talk about it afterwards. Yeah.
So unanswered questions, even the answer questions are still wondrous to how things end up working. It's not a great question.
What he's suggesting is 100 years from now, we'll have explanation of how something had a Big Bang once upon a time started from nothing. In other words, the Big Bang was a bunch of pressure that, you know, a lot of pressure and pressure and pressure, the whole thing just exploded and created and that. In other words, even though right now we don't know exactly where it came from, where it is, but there's so much about the Big Bang that we don't know. He's saying, well, maybe we'll know more in the future, and maybe that information that we'll know in the future will be helpful or hurtful to our argument. It could be one of a million things.
Maybe we'll know in the future about what caused the thing, what caused that in the first place.
Maybe. I don't know. It's so difficult to respond to this question because I don't know what scientists are going to find out 100 years from now. The best I could do with what I got. Yeah.
Why don't you think it's 100%?
Why don't I think it's 100% proof? There's nothing logical, there's no logical proof about it. If anything, it's just like, it makes a lot of sense to suggest something like that. Like, hey, look at that, I'm really impressed. It probably, there's nothing about that, 100% proof. It's not like 2 plus 2 equals 4 kind of mathematical, it's just like...
It's like strong circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, circumstantial evidence. That's my thing. So circumstantial evidence is not a proof. I mean, how would you reject something like this? You would say, you can say something along like it. You can go like the quickest way out with like a deist, which is like God created the world and left, but that's really not really rejecting it. You could say like, just because it seems so intuitively true to believe all this circumstantial evidence, it's just not there. That's what I said a minute ago, but just particularly better now. Number two. The Aruch HaShulchan in the beginning of Aruch Chaim starts off before he talks about all about halachas, which is really the whole sefer Aruch HaShulchan. He has a few philosophical and ideological hashkafic points which he gets off to. One of them is a famous one. The truth is Mark Twain said, although Mark Twain was an atheist, again, this, nonetheless, the existence of the Jews, the people, how they persevered, etc., etc. More or less, you look at the this is also found in the world of Mepharshim. You look around at history, look around at the modern world. You look around and just a person says, my goodness, you know, I could see God's hand, you know, if he's the puppeteer in the world, but he's at least on some level, you know, I could find Hashgacha Pratis, I could see God, you know, what's the word, through the divine intervention, his divine hand maybe behind the curtains, however you want to see it, something like that. And a lot of people talk about this in terms of proof to God, support to God as well, which is twofold. Number one is what most professionals say. Number two is a little bit of a modern alternative or additional perspective. Number one is, you know, they talk about how the Jewish people has persevered through world history without a land, without a homeland, without a country. You know, some people talk about where's the Greek philosopher, where's the Roman soldier. So much of the world has disappeared and moved away. The amount of Jews that exist in this world, and that existed 2,500 years ago, any good statistician would have guessed, without a country, without a homeland, they would not have made it. And the fact that they've made it, the fact that they've persevered, the fact that they've carried through, definitely says it's worthwhile thinking twice. Now, is that convincing? I don't think it's compelling. I don't think so. But definitely has something to be said. Definitely something to be said. If Mark Twain, who was an atheist, thought that at least the evidence was somewhat interesting, it could be that he's right. The Aruch HaShulchan took it one step further than Mark Twain and said it was not just interesting, but actually it pointed to a direction, which is not just that God exists, but a step further, God exists and he chose the Jewish people, you know, guards over and watches the Jewish people, etc., etc. Step further. I'll just add in one more dimension to this thing, which is modern Zionism. You look around the world, if you're convinced, and I think this is maybe more convincing than the first, because I'm living through it, maybe my perspective on history is not great enough, but you look around the world, the fact that the Jews persevered for 2,000 years, you know, without a country, without a homeland, through all sorts of opposition, through all sorts of anti-Semitism and pogroms and things along that nature that try to either wipe out Jews and or Judaism, that's definitely something I think noteworthy. So there's a second value, which is after 2,000 years, HaKadosh Baruch Hu returned us back to our homeland. Meaning, I remember one of the main arguments the Catholic Church has, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's somewhere in France, there's a sculpture of a picture of a Jew with his hand over his eye. I learned in college I took a class on art history, and I was like, why is the Jew with his hand over his eye? And basically it was Christian theology, which is, Jew, you're so blind, it's so obvious that Christianity is correct. Where does this come from? It was, the Jews were the chosen people. God selected them, gave them a Torah, gave them a base, and made this, they screwed up. God said, I'll give you a second chance, gave them a second base. And so the Jews just acted so terribly to each other. The Bein Am L'Chaveiro was so negative, so poor, so bad. Then why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroy the second base of Mikdash? Sinas Chinam. Well, Chazal aren't the only one who said that. Jesus basically said the exact same thing as well. That you Jews treat each other like, but terribly. It's absolutely horrific how you Jews treat each other. And if you read the stories of Qamsi and Bar Qamsi, they're nothing compared to the books found, the stories found in history, the Civil War, and how much butchered each other. It's absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. You'd be shocked. I'm saying that, in other words, I don't know why we don't learn more of this history. It's horrific how much the hate was for each other and the war and ideological battles and military, etc., etc. He says they actually treat each other terribly. And Jesus came out, let's get rid of Bein Am L'Malko. Let's keep it simple. Believe in God. The new mission, which is what Jesus, etc., etc. Keep the Bein Am L'Chaveiro. That's all you got to stick with. And the Jews didn't take that either. And therefore, they were no longer the chosen people. God passed them over and chose the Christians instead. And the Jews responded, hey, our ideology is God will never pass up his nation. We're still the chosen people. And the Christian said, you're chosen. Chosen for what? You have no country. You have no base on Mikdash. You're the minority amongst the world. You're scattered amongst the nations. People treat you like people treat you like garbage. The Soloveitchik pointed out, the biggest chil Hashem in all of world history was the Holocaust, because it gave so much credence to this argument. Could you imagine how Hashem treats his own people? People, you shouldn't treat animals this way. Salvation concluded was the only way, the only Kiddush Hashem that could have possibly offset the tremendous chilul Hashem of the Holocaust was Hakamas HaBedin. But after 2,000 years, when the Christians thought it would just be a matter of time until the Jews were wiped off the face of the earth, until they totally assimilated in and were lost in terms of the numbers, the fact that we return home is absolutely miraculous. And by the way, the church at first didn't want to acknowledge the state of Israel, and that's because it was it flew in the face of their theology. And for 50 or 60 years, they didn't do it. Until about, I think, in the 1990s, if I'm not mistaken, 1994, something like that. Mm-hmm. Something like that. The Catholic Church basically took like a 180 and said, the Metzius is so much against our theology, we have to rethink. And they came with the following conclusion, which is, it must be that all Jews must return to Israel before Jesus comes back a second time. And that's why you find stuff like the original Nefesh B'Nefesh flights being funded by Baptist money and evangelical money. Where does that come from? Southern Baptist and evangelical. Where does that come from? It comes from Jews must return to Israel. So this day, millions and millions of dollars being poured in. This guy, Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein, Wings of Eagles pours in. I think in the last like 10 years, he brought $300 million of Christian money to help make Jews make Aliyah. It's a lot of money. I'm saying besides Israel and the agency, no other foundation putting in money like that. Maybe Nefesh B'Nefesh is close. So just bringing in money for Jews. Where is this coming from? So again, we believe that it's not Jesus' second coming. We believe God did not abandon his people who have stuff on it. And he told us, and he warned us, he said, I'll come back. And you look around the world, sometimes you get the impression God is going from country to country to country to country and telling you, get out of this country, get out of that country. And in World War II, it was get out, otherwise you'll die. And in some other places, get out, otherwise you'll assimilate. And sometimes the Iron Wall falls and a bunch of countries go at one time. But you look, there's only one country in the entire world where the Jewish population is growing, and it's Israel. There's only one country in the entire world where the assimilation rate is under 50%, and it's Israel, where it's under 1%. Big gap. If I'm not mistaken. Anything wrong? The assimilation rate, the intermarriage rate? I'm sorry, I said assimilation. In terms of becoming now from here, the intermarriage rate. Again, it's not surprising. I mean, it's not shocking. It's some percentage of a percent. It's like a half or two thirds of a percent, something like that. There are some people who marry Arabs or who knows who else here in Israel, but really, it's unbelievably low. So the Israeli population, if I'm not mistaken, has grown every single year in Israel since Hakamas HaMedina. There's not been a year where it's gone down. Is this the kibbutz goliath the prophets were talking about? It definitely could be. Am I convinced? I'm not convinced, but it could be. Every year there are more yeshivas, there's more Torah, there's more Shabbos being kept. The percentage of religious Jews is going up every year as well. We could be living through really exciting times. This could be like, you know, you look around the world, you look at history. Am I convinced? Is it a black and white proof? No, but is it very possible that everything with the book that the prophets had prophesied about, that the Nevi'im had nevuah about, we're living through? It could be. It definitely could be. That being the case, one may argue a second major proof, not just towards God, but specifically Judaism, is that look in the world of history. Is it a black and white proof? Absolutely not. I'm not 100% convinced. But I'm definitely open to the... It definitely allows me to feel more comfortable with Torah and mitzvahs. Yeah?
Is it possible that precisely the persecution you spoke about could be a rational explanation as to why...
Is there a rational explanation why...
And then why Jews have continued is precisely because they have been persecuted, not despite the persecution.
You could say something like that. Again, let me take a step back. God didn't... In other words, even if God somehow, you know, supervised it from up above, he probably did it. I mean, it wasn't totally miraculous. It was working within the worlds of nature. Now, whether or not that is surprising enough that it leads towards God, or no, explained rationally, the answer is yes. Would it be dafka that? There are probably all sorts of other persecuted people who lost their identity as a nation. I have to look at world history more. I have to think about it more. You know, both. What?
Five of the fists as well.
That would be the opposite, right? When the five of the fists, I mean, the more you get persecuted, the less you survive.
You know, then the killer one survived, and that's the next impression of a high chance of survival.
Right, but when people are killing you and wiping you out, that would lead against it, right? In other words, if you're more clever, if you can, you know, if there's more odds, if survival finishes, the odds are all equal, the best will survive. Once the odds are no longer equal, if they're totally stacked against you and you survive, that's no longer survival finish. That's, you know, the opposite. In any event, there's a third major argument that's found in the Mefarshim. It's probably most popularly identified with the Kuzari. The Kuzari makes the point, basically it's the Mesorah, but I'll sharpen it a little bit. I'm going to say it in two ways. Three ways. Number one is that my father told me Judaism is correct. So either he's right, or he's wrong. And if he's wrong, it's because he made a mistake or because he's lying. I don't think he's lying to me. He dedicated his whole life to it, and he gave everything he had to give me the push to do it. So most likely he's either right or he's wrong. But there's a good chance he's right. He's definitely not lying. And therefore, I'm willing to bank on the fact that my father told it to me, and his father told it to him, and father, all the way up. Back to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. Safe argument. It's called a Masorah argument. Now the problem is that what? Okay, but Christopher heard from his father Peter, heard from his father Paul, or heard from his father, I don't know, Luke, who heard from some other Christian name all the way back up as well, that Jesus said to him that, you know, he's doing all sorts of miracles, walked on the water, did the Galilee, in other words, came back to life 3 days after he died. All sorts of miraculous things as well, and he walked around down to the other side of town over here. But I tell you, Muhammad had all sorts of prophecies, did all sorts of great things. So what's the difference? So I think the difference is at the top of my Masorah, my father said, yeah, I was at Har Sinai. That's a huge thing. And just to put a second perspective on it, I don't think there's another claim in all of world history as large as this that's difficult to imagine is true. Meaning, it'd be so difficult to say that 600,000 men, ages 22, 50 or 60, I forgot, 60? Have heard, experienced the revolution that Hashem did at Har Sinai. The mass revelation at Har Sinai. Now that revelation, that mass revelation, it would be so difficult to conjure up. Meaning, how could it have been conjured up? It could be 600,000 people got together and pretended. It'd be very difficult to imagine that really occurred. To gather two people together to pretend that occurred would be difficult, but 600,000 is almost out of the question. To get few people to start saying, hey, 600,000 people will do it, let's commit our lives to something. Again, people don't want to commit their lives to Judaism or anything for that matter if they don't think it's true, especially with such a major sacrifice. And therefore, it would be very difficult to get this thing starting unless it really is true. Now, to be honest, you can shoot this down as well, but I do think that it's the claim, meaning if I was to reject civil war, the American Civil War, to reject the 100 years war, one of these things, it really require a lot. In other words, the whole world basically accepts it. In other words, it'd be difficult for the whole world to just have made up the fact that it was a 100 years war. Same type of thing, it'd be a difficult claim to make that, you know, that Hashem never experienced, that the mass revelation that took place didn't really occur. Were they lying? Did they make it up? Where did this thing come from? Again, is it impossible? No, but it'd be a difficult thing to make. One last thing. I'm not sure how much this plays into a role in terms of Masorah, but if anyone's interested, I have a list on my computer of every single generation from me back to Moshe Rabbeinu. I'll show it to you afterwards. Person to person. I think I'm generation 130, if I'm not mistaken. But I'll show it to you afterwards, I'm saying. What? I didn't put it together. I sent it to a bunch of British guys who probably used it for VA. You may see it there. I actually got from Gary Jacob Glasser. He put the list together. He does NCSY in New Jersey. And it's a fantastic thing. So I'm not sure how much that aids and it doesn't add in. Again, it could be maybe some name was made up. Maybe like Abayi never existed. But like the odds are he probably did. You know what I mean? He's like part of Masorah. It could be Rashi never existed. But the odds are he probably did. You know what I mean? Like it could be some guy made up Rashi's parish. But like if you can go all the way back generation to generation, it could really say something. In any event, those are the three major suggestions, arguments, proofs, so to speak, that are found in the Chachmei HaMasorah, that are found in our tradition. Number one is the watchmaker theory that Rabbi Kiva and the cloak with the heretic. Number two is what the Aruch HaShulchan talks about, the perseverance and the continuation of Am Yisrael. And number three is the Kuzari's argument with the Masorah. We had, I guess, three A, B, and C, three different models of it. Those are the three major arguments. Let me just get one or two more points out. Stick around. I have to want to finish at 11:15, like I always try to. Let me just get a few more things out. These, I think, are some of the major arguments towards God, or towards God specifically, and Jewish as well. Again, most people choose God based upon social, emotional, psychological, whatever they are, reasons that they choose God. But I do think these are arguments out there that are basic and simple and straightforward enough that it allows a person to commit with, and maybe there are others that I didn't mention, but it allows a person to commit with some sense of confidence. To be honest with you, the question really is not can I prove God, but are the arguments strong enough that you feel comfortable making the leap of faith? And I do believe it is a leap of faith. And there are also delayed experience that indicated. In other words, the famous expression, there's no atheist in a foxhole, which means when you really, really need it, you come out to believe. Again, is that an emotional thing, a psychological thing, et cetera, et cetera? At some point in time, we'll talk about why a person would commit to be religious, and I do think that's really the next stage. We'll talk about it next week. Why would a person commit to being religious? Why would a person say, okay, these proofs are 50% good, 80% good, 20% good. Why am I willing to make the next jump, to make the commitment, to make that leap of faith, etc., etc.? Why would a person do that? Why would it be in the best interest? Why would a person want to do something like that? But that's the real question, is are you really willing to make that gamble? Is the gamble worth it? And I think that hopefully these arguments, as well as others, would make it a person feel confident and comfortable enough to make the leap of faith. All right, Mr. Shem will pick up next week.
The question that Muslims recognize that that happens.
Correct. I guess that would prove one of the three religions. And again, you're 100% correct. In other words, that be an argument if I was giving class, you know, the Muslim code, I'd say that must be true. And that's the first stage. The next stage is.